Welcome to This Is How, an ACLU of North Carolina podcast that unlocks the untold stories of justice, freedom, and activism from right here in North Carolina. We will explore how we can make change happen one voice at a time. Get ready to be inspired, informed, and empowered to create a fairer future for all. And now, here's our host.
Hello, I'm Olivia with the ACLU of North Carolina. Last week, we dove into the complexities of the reproductive justice movement in North Carolina and how race and class continue to impact abortion access today. In today's episode, we'll explore the new legal restrictions on abortion access in North Carolina and how advocates are working to protect reproductive freedom despite the challenges. As the dust settles after the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Dobbs v. Jackson, we're witnessing a seismic shift in abortion rights across the country. In North Carolina, Senate Bill 20, dubbed the Monster Abortion Ban, has altered the landscape dramatically. Today, we'll hear from Dr. Beverly Gray, an abortion provider who will shed light on the challenges faced by both patients and healthcare professionals. But first, let's take a step back and go behind the headlines. As we talked about last week, before Senate Bill 20 was passed, North Carolina already had significant legal restrictions on abortion. For example, a person seeking an abortion would have to receive unnecessary state-mandated counseling, either over the phone or in person, and then wait 72 hours before they could come in for their abortion appointment. The law also banned several practices that are considered standard of care in the medical field, including providing abortion via telehealth, and having an advanced practice provider, such as a nurse practitioner, provide abortions. And finally, the fall of Roe allowed an old law that had been enjoined by the courts to go into effect, banning abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy, with few exceptions. A person seeking an abortion could also be tricked by fake clinics that pretend to provide medical care only to give false information and try to discourage people from choosing abortion. There are more than 100 of these fake clinics operating in North Carolina, and the state budget provides them with more than $20 million of taxpayer dollars. Fake clinics exist to prevent people from making informed decisions about their bodies, and they target vulnerable people who are looking for help. SB 20 went into effect on July 1st, adding several more restrictions. Abortion is now banned after 12 weeks, except for cases of rape or incest, and when the pregnant person's life is in danger. These narrow exceptions can be difficult to practice, since doctors could face legal action if they determine that a patient's life is in danger and a court disagrees. Additionally, for people who have experienced rape or incest to access care, they must share intimate personal details of their lives with their medical providers, whether they want to or not. Even for someone who is within the 12-week window, they have to come in person to the clinic to receive the mandated counseling and then wait 72 hours before they can come in for their procedure. For those who have to drive several hours to get to their appointment, that makes a big difference. In reaction to SB 20, the ACLU of North Carolina and Planned Parenthood South Atlantic sued to put a temporary restraining order on some of the more vague and confusing provisions of the bill. Because of the lawsuit, the state passed a bill removing some of the problematic provisions, and a judge approved the restraining order for the rest, so they will not be enforceable while the case moves through the courts. However, even with these few provisions blocked, the Guttmacher Institute estimates abortion rates in North Carolina, at least for abortions provided through official medical channels, dropped by over 30% in the month after SB 20 went into effect. Even with these new restrictions, North Carolina is one of the last bastions of abortion care in the South. Since the Dobbs decision, advocates have watched as abortion access has fallen state by state, with devastating consequences for people across the South and many other parts of the country. We must protect abortion access here in our state, not just for North Carolinians, but for people across the Southeast and the country. We're now going to speak with Dr. Beverly Gray, a practicing OBGYN and associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Duke. Dr. Gray has been an abortion provider for over a decade and has been a fierce advocate for reproductive freedom in North Carolina. Last year, she partnered with Planned Parenthood South Atlantic to file the lawsuit that successfully challenged several provisions of SB 20. I'm here with Dr. Beverly Gray. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. So my name's Bev Gray, or Beverly. You can call me either one. I am an OBGYN. I live here in Durham, North Carolina, and provide care for patients in North Carolina and now Virginia. I'm a complex family planner, so that means that I provide complex contraception, abortion care, miscarriage care, but I also provide just general OBGYN care. So yesterday I was on labor and delivery, welcoming new life into the world. So it's a mix of a lot of different things that I do in my job. But I've also been very involved in advocacy especially these last 2 years and even before, just seeing what my patients experience has influenced my path and what I feel is the right thing to do for patients, which is not always just care inside the exam room. It sometimes involves, understanding the law and pushing back against the law.
Yeah, absolutely. We've talked a little bit already about what Senate Bill 20 is and how it's impacted the legal sphere, but I really want to know, how has SB 20 impacted your practice and the way that, your patients, the way that you practice medicine and how your practice operates?
So it's a long bill. It's 46 mm-hmm. pages long. It was very confusing. And so I think the initial impact, sort of like the shock and awe, sort of approach by the legislature to make it really complicated, put so much red tape between, providing necessary care and then doing all this extra busy work. And then for us in our clinic, we had to completely move our clinic space to comply with kind of the new law. And we had to do that in the span of 6 weeks, which you can imagine was very complicated, stressful, involved 60 plus people on weekly meetings trying to make sure we had everything together. Since Dobbs, I have met with so many lawyers so many times just to understand the mifepristone rulings, Dobbs, SB 20, like what does that mean for us? What does that mean for our patients? And I think as a physician, when you go into this work, you don't anticipate all of this extra stress and this extra red tape just to be able to do what's right for people. And I think that's been really frustrating, living through SB 20.
Yeah. You mentioned that you work with residents. How is it, training the next generation of providers when things have changed so rapidly in the medical world?
I mean, I think medical students who are looking at residency positions are being very thoughtful about where they live. So geography's always been really important for residents. They want to be near a support system. People feel strong ties to their home. So, I grew up in Western North Carolina, did my residency here in Durham, and I wanted to stay here. I wanted to care for the patients of the community where I'd lived so long and where I felt really strong ties to. And people feel that all across the nation. But I think now students are making decisions that are maybe influenced by the law and not necessarily geography. They may move away from their family to get the necessary training they need to be able to safely care for people. And abortion care is part of that safe, necessary training. And so I think when they don't have access to that, they're trained in a substandard way.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you have a sense of, what the logistical impact has been on patients and then also the emotional impact of these restrictions that have been added?
Yeah. So, I think it creates tremendous logistical hurdles for patients. So, we now have to counsel patients in person and read this very patronizing script that patients have to initial every single line. And it creates this unfortunate dynamic between providers and patients where now they're forced to read this text that maybe isn't medically necessary. It maybe isn't pertinent at all to the patient's situation. And I think the assumption by those making this law is that we're not going to counsel our patients in the proper way, which we always do. I think so it's just disrespectful to us and our practice to have to interject this additional in-person meeting, this additional counseling. And so it doubles the number of appointments. And then for patients seeking medication abortion, it triples the necessary appointments. So, we've cared for patients who have gone to Virginia, even though they were below the gestational age limit, just because they couldn't take 2 days off of work because they need a day off for the counseling, a day off for the actual medical care. And people just can't carve out that time in their lives. And so it's unfortunate that patients are doing that. And then if patients are beyond that gestational age limit, if they're able to travel, then they're traveling great distances for care. Yeah. And we know that border states where there are bans are overwhelmed with patients seeking care.
Yeah. I feel like there's been so many bills in the last 10 years where there's a lot of medical misinformation, mm-hmm. but the intention behind that misinformation is to perpetuate the idea that those provisions are needed. Like the mandatory counseling is sort of implying that doctors are encouraging patients to have an abortion without educating them on and giving them like truly informed consent, which is just not true.
That's not true at all. And I mean, there've been, you know, a lot of situations where a patient comes to seek care and maybe abortion isn't the right decision for them. And so we spend a lot of time with those patients really kind of talking through what are the possibilities for their lives. Is this what they need right now? Do they want to wait a week or two? Like they're, and I think this idea that we're pushing patients towards this path is just, it's ludicrous. And, you know, patients are able to make thoughtful decisions. They don't need to have all these other extra barriers to be able to make a decision. And it just places extra stigma on necessary medical care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think people are starting to understand better what abortion is and all of the different ways that abortion can be provided and all of the different reasons why abortion might be necessary. I mean, certainly with the cases that we've seen where a fetus is unviable. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in the past, the procedure to like doing a DNC on that type of fetus would not be like politicized in this way.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, a lot of the cases in the news are often these exceptional cases or cases that meet exceptions. I think exceptions are unethical, first of all. And I've written about that before. And I think with exceptions, you have like these spheres of compassion. So you have like this little tiny sphere of like, okay, I can, in these situations, I can have compassion for these patients. And I think there's this lack of understanding of all of the other people that live in our community and in our world that need compassion for reasons that maybe aren't in that tight sphere that people willing to offer exceptions are willing to give. You know, when I see a patient who says to me, you know, I grew up in poverty, I have a child under one, and I know what it's like to live on mayonnaise sandwiches and cereal for dinner, and I don't want that for my family. And if I have this other pregnancy, that's what my life is going to be like. I'm going to be struggling to make ends meet for my daughter. You know, and I've had patients say things like that to me, and it just, how can you not have compassion for someone in that situation? You know, many patients who seek abortion care are victims of intimate partner violence. And so maybe it's not the case of rape or incest, but they're living with violence every day in their lives. How can we not have compassion for those patients? How can we not have compassion for patients who just say, you know what, pregnancy is no joke. I don't want to bring a child into the world. I want to make this decision because it's my human right to make this decision. Have compassion for those people too. And so I think when people make exceptions, you have this small group of people who are deciding, okay, in these cases, we can be compassionate. But in these cases, no.
Yeah. We've definitely seen evidence that exceptions don't work. You know, I think that the longer we've had these bills in place, the more evidence we're seeing that doctors are afraid to cross a line that is very blurry in the law about, you know, what is appropriate for these exceptions. And also my understanding is that rape and incest victims who want an abortion have to share that information with their provider, mm-hmm. and they might not want to do that and might not be ready to do that.
There are a lot of reasons why people mistrust the medical system. And so then to be required to say that. And then in North Carolina, if you're under 18 and you report rape or incest, that's a mandatory reporting event. And so we're required to report that. And so there are reasons why people don't want to disclose that information. Yeah. And I don't think we should force them to. Yeah, I think it creates a difficult interaction for patients who are now feeling like they're forced to share that information to meet the necessary requirements for care.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're hearing a lot of really heavy stories, and obviously you've seen a lot of patients who are in dire circumstances and who are being forced to seek care elsewhere or who are being forced to, you know, jump through these hoops. What has the impact been on providers and staff who are, you know, having to turn patients away or having to counsel patients in a way that doesn't conform to what they feel is the standard of care?
I mean, there's tremendous moral injury from this process, right? You have the skills, you have the knowledge, you have the expertise to provide care, and you're unable to. And I think at the end of June, when we were starting to get patients calling for appointments, our person who does a lot of the scheduling sits in the same workroom with the physicians. And so we were sitting with her. And I remember just a couple of those days, just like going home in tears, because I heard her turn away multiple patients every day. And so when these new laws start, there's tremendous confusion. And even after the laws start, there's a lot of confusion. You know, a lot of patients think that abortion's banned in North Carolina and don't understand the complexities of the law. A lot of physicians don't understand the complexities of the law. So there's been a lot of education that we're trying to do about that.
Lawyers have a hard time understanding the law.
And so, disagree about interpretation of the law. But I think for providers and, you know, our nursing staff and our clinic staff, you know, it was really, really tough because we know the data about what happens to patients who are turned away from abortion care. They are more likely to live in poverty. They are more likely to remain tethered to an abusive partner. They're less likely to bond with their children. There are all of these economic impacts of not receiving wanted care. And so with every single patient we turn away, we don't know what happens on the end of that conversation. Are they able to get care in Virginia? Are they able to go to another state where maybe they have a family member? Maybe. But maybe they're forced to continue that pregnancy. And maybe they have an adverse pregnancy outcome. And that's heartbreaking.
We've been thinking a lot about crisis pregnancy centers and how to explain to people what they are and how they operate. And I'm wondering if that's something that you can help, shed light on, and how fake abortion clinics like this impact real medical care.
So I think a lot of these crisis pregnancy centers can be very deceptive. I mean, as a physician, I've looked at some of the websites, and it is hard for me to tell, like, is this a clinic where someone could get abortion care or not? So there's no regulation of these places. We've cared for patients who have gotten ultrasounds there who are told, oh, you need an actual doctor now because they may have an ectopic pregnancy or a miscarriage, but they're not actually, like, there's no one observing them, making sure that they're, maintaining the right recommendations for care, the right recommendations for ultrasound. So, patients could be misdiagnosed, and ectopic pregnancy is the number one killer in the first trimester of pregnancy. And so this is like a serious thing. So the patients are going to these clinics, maybe getting misinformation. We've had patients being told that they were not as far along as they were. And so then when they come for care, they're too far along. They're given misinformation about how dangerous abortion is, which, medication abortion, procedural abortion, they're both very safe. One of the most common, procedures that's performed in this country, it's way more safe than pregnancy. Yet they're given a lot of they just use a lot of scare tactics to make patients feel like, okay, I'm really, going to be scared, or this is going to be really dangerous if I want to do that. And so, we've cared for patients who come in and they're in tears right before a procedure or while they're receiving care. And when we try to, understand a little bit more what's behind that, it's because they've been told how dangerous abortion is. And it's not. Abortion is very safe. And so now these clinics have increased the stigma, increased the fear about seeking care, potentially given, you know, bad medical information to patients based on whatever ultrasound they've performed. And so it's unfortunate that they receive a tremendous amount of money yet they have zero regulations. Whereas we provide very safe care. We are under a lot of regulations based on, you know, being a clinic and providing abortion care and just, you know, being in a hospital system. Like we are, you know, it's, medicine's highly regulated just in general. And so adding all these extra regulations that don't make abortion safer, yet you have all these CPCs out there with zero regulations and tons of money. It's ironic.
Yeah. One of the red flags that I've seen for the websites, as far as like recognizing what is a real clinic and what is not, is that they often say they are providing physician quality ultrasounds, which really just means that they're not being provided by a physician. So they're suggesting that, you know, they are providing care that is up to the standard of physicians, but they have no way of doing that because they're not trained.
I mean, that can be one way to detect, like, if it's a fake clinic.
Yeah, definitely. Can you think of any other ways that you might recognize, you know, red flags for what is a fake clinic?
Yeah, I mean, often they'll refer to medication abortion as chemical abortion, or they'll have, you know, improper stats around safety of abortion care. Like they include some information on their websites about abortion just to make it seem legit, but it can be complicated for patients to understand. I think for patients, if they know where to find trusted care, so like going to Abortion Finder, or like, you know, understanding like which websites are going to have like information about clinics that are providing medical care.
Yeah, definitely. That's helpful because I think that people feel so overwhelmed and sometimes lost, especially like you said, in this political climate where they're uncertain what the law is. Yeah, having those trusted resources where they can go and get accurate information is so important. We've been trying to, we've built an abortion toolkit on our website that where the intention is for folks who are seeking abortion to have just a compact list of everything that they might need to know, including beyond the spectrum of care, you know, child care, transportation, funding, how to handle when they encounter protesters and all of these different facets of the experience that can be just compounding on each other.
Yeah. And we know that most people seeking care already have a family. And so child care, transportation, those are huge issues that our patients face. And so a lot of times when we're helping arrange care, it's not, you know, like necessarily like in the logistics, not necessarily related to the actual medical care, which we go over those things. Those are pretty straightforward. It's more of like, okay, how can you get off work? How can you pay for this care? Because, you know, Medicaid in North Carolina does not have a provision due to the Hyde Amendment to pay for abortion care. So the majority of patients in pregnancy have Medicaid for their coverage and have to pay out of pocket for care.
Yeah, I mean, who's going to drive you home? And, you know, yeah, I think there's so many considerations that someone might have to make. So you are the plaintiff in the lawsuit against the state for SB 20, challenging several of the provisions that are unclear or unconstitutional. Can you talk a little bit about how you came into that role and why you chose to do that?
So this isn't the first time I sued the state of North Carolina. I was also involved in the 20-week ban suit back in 2016. So I've worked with the ACLU before, and, you know, I think as a citizen of this country, we have a right to stand up and say, you know, these laws are bad, these laws are unconstitutional, and as a physician, you understand how irrational these laws are. And there were definitely certain provisions that stood out as ones that are unconstitutional, and I think I felt a very deep responsibility to be a part of the lawsuit and to stand up for the patients that I care for and to stand up for the care that I provide that I think is absolutely healthcare, that it should not have so much red tape and so many extra provisions. You know, when SB 20 came out and they were kind of having that, you know, the press conference where they were talking about all the different provisions, I was actually out at dinner. We had a visiting professor coming to Durham and we were having like this lovely dinner, and I get multiple frantic phone calls. And so I had to step out. You know, it's this beautiful day. Like, it was like end of April, beginning of May. And we were kind of waiting for it to come out. And I think we were all extremely disappointed, but I just remember feeling so frantic and so scared for what was going to happen for our patients. And when you're facing that, I think you have to push back. You have to like speak out and say, you know, this is wrong. You know, immediately they made all those amendments for clarity, but there were still provisions that we felt were important to stand up against.
Yeah, absolutely. You answered my next question, which was, you know, were you surprised by SB 20? So it seems like no.
Well, I wasn't surprised yet. I was still trying to maintain a sense of optimism, mm-hmm. right? Like, there was hope that, you know, maybe we could pull through and people would have some sense about them that this was bad for people, for the people of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were hoping that someone would stand up and say, you know what, I just don't agree with this. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case.
Watching the floor debate on SB 20 was really disheartening, because so much of what the legislators were saying was medically inaccurate, was right. stigmatizing, was just wrong. And it feels really frustrating, you know, as a North Carolinian, to watch these people who are elected into office with, you know, supposedly to represent all North Carolinians, who are lying, and there's no way to stop that. And it feels like, you know, it feels really challenging when the system feels unfair. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think with the gerrymandering, it does feel stacked against us, but I think, you know, even though all of this has happened, I feel like you can't give up hope that what is just and what is right for people of North Carolina that's the future that we all aspire to.
Yeah.
And I think people speaking out against SB 20, the momentum around that gives me hope. This next generation of voters, that gives me hope. You know, the young people of North Carolina are going to save us. And that gives me hope. I definitely had like my moment for wallowing. There's this Instagram feed called Disappointing Affirmations. I don't know if you, but they're hilarious. They're all very sarcastic, but we printed one out and put it up in our clinic, and it said, "Don't be sad. You're making everyone uncomfortable." and so, you know, we got through like our sad moment, and now we're, you know, focused on kind of the next phase and the next steps, and how can we continue to provide the best quality care possible, even with these provisions. And, you know, people are resilient. People will find a way to get what they need in their lives. And I think, you know, Roe was not perfect, and we need a better solution for people in this country, for their care and for their lives. And abortion care is liberating. Abortion care changes people's life trajectories, and it saves lives. I've seen it save lives. And we just have to keep, you know, keep hope that one day there will be more understanding of that. You know, if you look at people who are against abortion and are, you know, proponents of laws like SB 20, they often have the least understanding about pregnancy. And so that's my responsibility. That's the responsibility of the medical institution, is to educate people about the risk of pregnancy, to educate people about the safety of abortion. And, you know, we have a lot of work to do, but, you know, we're not giving up. And I think, you know, there's a lot of joy in this resistance too. You know, mm-hmm. the people that are doing this work are some of the best people on the planet. I am permanently trauma bonded to some of the best people in the world, because we've worked through these problems together. We've come up with solutions together. We've continued to provide care together. And that's a future I aspire to.
I really appreciate you speaking to that. I think that's exactly what we're trying to do with this podcast is we're trying to figure out a way forward and lean into hope, because feeling hopeless is so stagnating and it prevents you from moving forward. So I'm really glad that you have found that sort of window into a hopeful future. I think that's incredibly important for any movement.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Gray, for being here. And I just really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. I think we're really trying to listen to the people who are most directly involved with this issue. And yeah, I think having you as a provider speak to the issue is really helpful. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
As we move forward, we recognize the emotional burden that patients and providers must carry now that our most basic human rights have been violated. We are facing an uphill battle for reproductive freedom, but having hope for the future of the movement is critical to our survival and perseverance. We can only do this if we work in community with each other, recognizing the intersecting issues that impact abortion access and striving to undermine all systems of oppression. As long as we work together and stand our ground, the fight for reproductive justice in North Carolina is far from over. If you missed it, we highly recommend listening to last week's episode, in which we explored on-the-ground methods for advocacy and everyday actions you can take to contribute to the movement. We would also like to extend an invitation for you to watch our upcoming documentary, North Carolina's Abortion Story. This film explores the rich history of abortion rights and reproductive justice in North Carolina. Premier events will be hosted at locations near you. For more information, please visit our website or follow us on social media.
Thank you for joining This Is How, brought to you by the ACLU of North Carolina. If this episode resonates with you, we challenge you to take action. If you go to aclu of North Carolina.org, you'll find ways to donate and volunteer. Join us on social media as well. And if you like the show, share it with your network, subscribe on YouTube or a podcast app, or give us a rating at ratethispodcast.com/ACLUNC. This episode was edited and produced by Earfluence. Thanks again, and we'll see you soon on This Is How.